physical or mental, a version of the theory can work. All that females need is a dependable tool for diagnosis. Doctors don't use an erection test in routine health checkups. They prefer to ask you to stick out your tongue. But erection failure is a known early warning of diabetes and certain neurological diseases. Far more commonly, it results from psychological factors, depression, anxiety, stress, overwork, loss of confidence and all that. In nature, one might imagine males low in the peck order being afflicted in this way. Some monkeys use the erect penis as a threat signal. It is not implausible that with natural selection refining their diagnostic skills, females could glean all sorts of clues about a male's health and the robustness of his ability to cope with stress from the tone and bearing of his penis. But a bone would get in the way. Anybody can grow a bone in the penis. You don't have to be particularly healthy or tough. So selection pressure from females forced males to lose the os penis, because then only genuinely healthy or strong males could present a really stiff erection, and the females could make an unobstructed diagnosis. There is a possible zone of contention here. How, it might be said, were the females who imposed the selection supposed to know whether the stiffness that they felt was bone or hydraulic pressure? After all, we began with the observation that a human erection can feel like bone. But I doubt if the females were really that easily fooled. They too were under selection, in this case not to lose bone but to gain judgment. And don't forget, the female is exposed to the very same penis when it is not erect, and the contrast is extremely striking. Bones cannot detumesce, though admittedly they can be retracted. Perhaps it is the impressive double life of the penis that guarantees the authenticity of the hydraulic advertisement. Now to the stethoscope. Consider another notorious problem of the bedroom, snoring. Today it may be just a social inconvenience. Once upon a time it could have been life or death. In the depths of a quiet night, snoring can be remarkably loud. It could summon predators from far and wide to the snorer and the group among whom he is lying. Why then do so many people do it? Imagine a sleeping band of our ancestors in some Pleistocene cave, males snoring each on a different note, females kept awake with nothing to do but listen. I suppose it is true that males snore the more. Are the males providing the females with deliberately advertised and amplified stethoscopic information? Could the precise quality and timbre of your snore be diagnostic of the health of your respiratory tract? I don't mean to suggest that people snore only when they are ill. Rather, the snore is like a radio carrier frequency, which drones on regardless. It is a clear signal which is modulated, in diagnostically sensitive ways, by the condition of the nose and throat. The idea of females preferring the clear trumpet note of unobstructed bronchi over virus-blown snorts is all very well, but I confess that I find it hard to imagine females positively going for a snorer at all. Still, personal intuition is notoriously unreliable. Perhaps at least this would make a research project for an insomniac doctor. Come to think of it, she might be in a good position to test the other theory as well. These two speculations should not be taken too seriously. They will have succeeded if they bring home the principle of Hamilton's theory about how females try to choose healthy males. Perhaps the most interesting thing about them is that they point out the link between Hamilton's parasite theory and Amos Zahavi's handicap theory, which we shall come on to shortly. If you follow through the logic of my penis hypothesis, males are handicapped by the loss of the bone, and the handicap is not just incidental. The hydraulic advertisement gains its effectiveness precisely because erection sometimes fails. Darwinian readers will certainly have picked up this handicap implication, and it may have aroused in them grave suspicions. I ask them to suspend judgment until they have heard the passage on a new way of looking at the handicap principle itself.
Zahavi puts forward his own maddeningly contrary handicap principle as a rival explanation to Fisher's. He points out that the very fact that females are trying to select for good genes among males opens the door to deception by the males. Strong muscles may be a genuinely good quality for a female to select, But then what is to stop males from growing dummy muscles with no more real substance than human padded shoulders? If it costs a male less to grow false muscles than real ones, sexual selection should favour genes for producing false muscles. It will not be long, however, before counter-selection leads to the evolution of females capable of seeing through the deception. Sir Harvey's basic premise is that false sexual advertisement will eventually be seen through by females. He therefore concludes that really successful males will be those who do not advertise falsely, those who palpably demonstrate that they are not deceiving. If it is strong muscles we're talking about, then males who merely assume the visual appearance of strong muscles will soon be detected by the females. But a male who demonstrates, by the equivalent of lifting weights or ostentatiously doing press-ups, that he really has strong muscles, will succeed in convincing the females. In other words, Sir Harvey believes that a he-man must not only seem to be a good quality male, he must really be a good quality male, otherwise he will not be accepted as such by sceptical females. Displays will therefore evolve that only a genuine he-man is capable of doing.
So far, so good. Now comes the part of Sir Harvey's theory that really sticks in the throat. He suggests that the tails of birds of paradise and peacocks, the huge antlers of deer, and the other sexually selected features which have always seemed paradoxical because they appear to be handicaps to their possessors, evolve precisely because they are handicaps. A male bird with a long and cumbersome tail is showing off to females that he is such a strong he-man that he can survive in spite of his tail. Think of a woman watching two men run a race. If both arrive at the finishing post at the same time, but one has deliberately encumbered himself with a sack of coal on his back, the woman will naturally draw the conclusion that the man with the burden is really the faster runner. I do not believe this theory, although I'm not quite so confident in my scepticism as I was when I first heard it. I pointed out then that the logical conclusion to it should be the evolution of males with only one leg and only one eye. Sir Harvey, who comes from Israel, instantly retorted, "Some of our best generals have only one eye." Nevertheless, the problem remains that the handicap theory seems to contain a basic contradiction. If the handicap is a genuine one, and it is of the essence of the theory that it has to be a genuine one, then the handicap itself will penalize the offspring just as surely as it may attract females. It is, in any case, important that the handicap must not be passed on to daughters.
If we rephrase the handicap theory in terms of genes, we have something like this. A gene that makes males develop a handicap, such as a long tail, becomes more numerous in the gene pool because females choose males who have handicaps. Females choose males who have handicaps because genes that make females so choose also become frequent in the gene pool. This is because females with a taste for handicapped males will automatically tend to be selecting males with good genes in other respects, since those males have survived to adulthood in spite of the handicap. These good other genes will benefit the bodies of the children, which therefore survive to propagate the genes for the handicap itself and also the genes for choosing handicapped males. Provided the genes for the handicap itself exert their effect only in sons, just as the genes for a sexual preference for the handicap affect only daughters, the theory just might be made to work. So long as it is formulated only in words, we cannot be sure whether it will work or not. We get a better idea of how feasible such a theory is when it is rephrased in terms of a mathematical model. So far, mathematical geneticists who've tried to make the handicap principle into a workable model have failed. This may be because it is not a workable principle, or it may be because they're not clever enough. If a male can demonstrate his superiority over other males in a way that does not involve deliberately handicapping himself, nobody would doubt that he could increase his genetic success in that way. Thus, elephant seals win and hold on to their harems not by being aesthetically attractive to females, but by the simple expedient of beating up any male who tries to move in on the harem. Harem holders tend to win these fights against would-be usurpers, if only for the obvious reason that that is why they are harem holders. Usurpers do not often win fights, because if they were capable of winning, they would have done so before. Any female who mates only with a harem holder is therefore allying her genes with a male who is strong enough to beat off successive challenges from the large surplus of desperate bachelor males. With luck, her sons will inherit their father's ability to hold a harem. In practice, a female elephant seal does not have much option, because the harem holder beats her up if she tries to stray. The principle remains, however, that females who choose to mate with males who win fights may benefit their genes by so doing. As we have seen, there are examples of females preferring to mate with males who hold territories and with males who have high status in the dominance hierarchy.
End note. In the first edition, I wrote in relation to Zahavi's theory, I do not believe this theory, although I am not quite so confident in my scepticism as I was when I first heard it. I am glad I added that, although, because the theory is now looking a lot more plausible than when I wrote the passage. Several respected theoreticians have recently started taking it seriously. Most worrying for me, these include my colleague Alan Graffen, who, as has been said in print before, has the most annoying habit of always being right. He has translated Zahavi's verbal ideas into a mathematical model and claims that it works, and that his model is not a fancy, esoteric travesty of Zahavi, such as others have played with, but a direct mathematical translation of Zahavi's idea itself. I shall discuss Graffen's original ESS version of his model, although he himself is now working on a full genetic version, which will in some ways supersede the ESS model. This doesn't mean that the ESS model is actually wrong. It is a good approximation. Indeed, all ESS models, including the ones in this book, are approximations in the same sense. The handicap principle is potentially relevant to all situations in which individuals try to judge the quality of other individuals, but we shall speak of males advertising to females. This is for the sake of clarity. It is one of those cases where the sexism of pronouns is actually useful. Graffen notes that there are at least four approaches to the handicap principle. These can be called the qualifying handicap. Any male who has survived in spite of his handicap must be pretty good in other respects, so females choose him. The revealing handicap. Males perform some onerous task in order to expose their otherwise concealed abilities. The conditional handicap. Only high-quality males develop a handicap at all. And finally, Graffen's preferred interpretation, which he calls the strategic choice handicap. Males have private information about their own quality, denied to females, and use this information to decide whether to grow a handicap and how large it should be. Graffen's strategic choice handicap interpretation lends itself to ESS analysis. There is no prior assumption that the advertisements that males adopt will be costly or handicapping. On the contrary, they are free to evolve any kind of advertisement, honest or dishonest, costly or cheap. But Graffen shows that, given this freedom to start with, a handicap system would be likely to emerge as evolutionarily stable. Graffen's starting assumptions are the following four. 1. Males vary in real quality. Quality is not some vaguely snobbish idea, like unthinking pride in one's old college or fraternity. I once received a letter from a reader which concluded, I hope you won't think this an arrogant letter, but after all, I am a Balliol man. Quality, for Graffen, means that there are such things as good males and bad males, in the sense that females would benefit genetically if they mated with good males and avoided bad ones. It means something like muscular strength, running speed, ability to find prey, ability to build good nests. We aren't talking about a male's final reproductive success, since this will be influenced by whether females choose him. To talk about that at this point would be to beg the whole question. It is something that may or may not emerge from the model. 2. Females cannot perceive male quality directly, but have to rely upon male advertising. At this stage, we make no assumption about whether the advertisements are honest. Honesty is something else that may or may not emerge from the model. Again, that is what the model is for. A male could grow padded shoulders, for instance, to fake an illusion of size and strength. It is the business of the model to tell us whether such a fake signal will be evolutionarily stable, or whether natural selection will enforce decent, honest, and truthful advertising standards. 3. Unlike the females eyeing them, males do, in a sense, know their own quality, and they adopt a strategy for advertising, a rule for advertising conditionally in the light of their quality. As usual, by know, I don't mean cognitively know, but males are assumed to have genes that are switched on conditionally upon the male's own quality, and privileged access to this information is a not unreasonable assumption. A male's genes, after all, are immersed in his internal biochemistry, and far better placed than female genes to respond to his quality. Different males adopt different rules. For instance, one male might follow the rule, display a tail whose size is proportional to my true quality. Another might follow the opposite rule. This gives natural selection a chance to adjust the rules by selecting among males that are genetically programmed to adopt different ones. The advertising level doesn't have to be directly proportional to the true quality. Indeed, a male could adopt an inverse rule. All that we require is that males should be programmed to adopt some kind of rule for looking at their true quality and on the basis of this, choosing an advertising level, size of tail, say, or of antlers. As to which of the possible rules will end up being evolutionarily stable, that again is something that the model aims to find out. 4. Females have a parallel freedom to evolve rules of their own. In their case, the rules are about choosing males on the basis of the strength of the male's advertisement. Remember that they, or rather their genes, lack the male's privileged view of the quality itself. For example, one female might adopt the rule, believe the males totally. Another female might adopt the rule, ignore male advertising totally. Yet another the rule, assume the opposite of what the advertisement says. So we have the idea of males varying in their rules for relating quality to advertising level, and females varying in their rules for relating mate choice to advertising level. In both cases, the rules vary continuously and under genetic influence. So far in our discussion, males can choose any rule relating quality to advertisement, and females can choose any rule relating male advertisement to what they choose. Out of this spectrum of possible male and female rules, what we seek is an evolutionarily stable pair of rules. This is a bit like the faithful philanderer and coy fast model, in that we are looking for an evolutionarily stable male rule and an evolutionarily stable female rule, stability meaning mutual stability, each rule being stable in the presence of itself and the other. If we can find such an evolutionarily stable pair of rules, we can examine them to see what life would be like in a society consisting of males and females playing by these rules. Specifically, would it be as a Harveian handicap world? Graffon set himself the task of finding such a mutually stable pair of rules. If I were to undertake this task, I should probably slog through a laborious computer simulation. I'd put into the computer a range of males, varying in their rule for relating quality to advertisement. And I'd also put in a range of females, varying in their rule for choosing males on the basis of the males' advertising levels. I then let the males and females rush around inside the computer, bumping into one another, mating if the female choice criterion is met, passing on their male and female rules to their sons and daughters. And of course, individuals would survive or fail to survive as a result of their inherited quality. As the generations go by, the changing fortunes of each of the male rules and each of the female rules would appear as changes in frequencies in the population. At intervals, I'd look inside the computer to see if some kind of stable mix was brewing. That method would work in principle, but it raises difficulties in practice. Fortunately, mathematicians can get to the same conclusion as a simulation would by setting up a couple of equations and solving them. This is what Graffon did. I shall not reproduce his mathematical reasoning, nor spell out his further more detailed assumptions. Instead, I shall go directly to the conclusion. He did indeed find an evolutionarily stable pair of rules. So, to the big question, does Graffon's ESS constitute the kind of world that Sir Harvey would recognize as a world of handicaps and honesty? The answer is yes. Graffon found that there can indeed be an evolutionarily stable world that combines the following Zahavian properties. 1. Despite having a free strategic choice of advertising level, males choose a level that correctly displays their true quality, even if this amounts to betraying that their true quality is low. At ESS, in other words, males are honest. 2. Despite having a free strategic choice of response to male advertisement, females end up choosing the strategy, believe the males. At ESS, females are justifiably trusting. 3. Advertising is costly. In other words, if we could somehow ignore the effects of quality and attractiveness, a male would be better off not advertising, thereby saving energy or being less conspicuous to predators. Not only is advertising costly, it is because of its costliness that a given advertising system is chosen. An advertising system is chosen precisely because it actually has the effect of reducing the success of the advertiser, all other things being equal. 4. Advertising is more costly to worse males. The same level of advertising increases the risk for a puny male more than for a strong male. Low-quality males incur a more serious risk from costly advertising than high-quality males. These properties, especially the third, that advertising is costly, are full-bloodedly Zahavian. Graffon's demonstration that they are evolutionarily stable under plausible conditions seems very convincing. But so also did the reasoning of Zahavi's critics, who influenced the first edition of this book, and who concluded that Zahavi's ideas could not work in evolution. We should not be happy with Graffon's conclusions until we have satisfied ourselves that we understand where, if anywhere, those earlier critics went wrong. What did they assume that led them to a different conclusion? Part of the answer seems to be that they did not allow their hypothetical animals a choice from a continuous range of strategies. This often meant that they were interpreting Zahavi's verbal ideas in one or other of the first three kinds of interpretation listed by Graffon, the qualifying handicap, the revealing handicap, or the conditional handicap. They did not consider any version of the fourth interpretation, the strategic choice handicap. The result was either that they couldn't make the handicap principle work at all, or that it worked but only under special, mathematically abstract conditions which did not have the full Zahavian paradoxical feel to them. Moreover, an essential feature of the strategic choice interpretation of the handicap principle is that at ESS, high-quality individuals and low-quality individuals are all playing the same strategy, advertise honestly. Earlier models assumed that high-quality males played different strategies from low-quality males, and hence developed different advertisements. Graffon, on the contrary, assumes that at ESS, differences between high and low-quality signalers emerge because they are all playing the same strategy, and the differences in their advertisements emerge because their differences in quality are being faithfully rendered by the signaling rule. We always admitted that signals, as a matter of fact, can be handicaps. We always understood that extreme handicaps could evolve, especially as a result of sexual selection, in spite of the fact that they were handicaps. The part of the Zahavi theory that we all objected to was the idea that signals might be favored by selection precisely because they were handicaps to the signalers. It is this that Alan Graffon has apparently vindicated. If Graffon is correct, and I think he is, it is a result of considerable importance for the whole study of animal signals. It might even necessitate a radical change in our entire outlook on the evolution of behavior, a radical change in our view of many of the issues discussed in this book. Sexual advertisement is only one kind of advertisement. The Zahavi-Graffon theory, if true, will turn topsy-turvy biologists' ideas of relations between rivals of the same sex, between parents and offspring, between enemies of different species. I find the prospect rather worrying, because it means that theories of almost limitless craziness can no longer be ruled out on common sense grounds. If we observe an animal doing something really silly, like standing on its head instead of running away from a lion, it may be doing it in order to show off to a female. It may even be showing off to the lion. I am such a high-quality animal, you would be wasting your time trying to catch me, an idea I will return to in the next chapter. But no matter how crazy I think something is, natural selection may have other ideas. An animal will turn back somersaults in front of a slavering pack of predators if the risks enhance the advertisement more than they endanger the advertiser. It is its very dangerousness that gives the gesture showing off power. Of course, natural selection won't favour infinite danger. At the point where exhibitionism becomes downright foolhardy, it will be penalised. A risky or costly performance may look crazy to us, but it really isn't any of our business. Natural selection alone is entitled to judge.
To sum up this chapter so far, the various different kinds of breeding system that we find among animals, monogamy, promiscuity, harems, and so on, can be understood in terms of conflicting interests between males and females. Individuals of either sex want to maximize their total reproductive output during their lives. Because of a fundamental difference between the size and numbers of sperms and eggs, males are in general likely to be biased towards promiscuity and lack of paternal care. Females have two main available counterploys, which we have called the he-man and the domestic bliss strategies. The ecological circumstances of a species will determine whether the females are biased towards one or other of these counterploys, and will also determine how the males respond. In practice, all intermediates between he-man and domestic bliss are found, and as we have seen, there are cases in which the father does even more childcare than the mother.
This book is not concerned with the details of particular animal species, so I will not discuss what might predispose a species towards one form of breeding system rather than another. Instead, I will consider the differences that are commonly observed between males and females in general, and show how these may be interpreted. I shall therefore not be emphasizing those species in which the differences between the sexes are slight, these being in general the ones whose females have favored the domestic bliss strategy. Firstly, it tends to be the males who go in for sexually attractive, gaudy colors, and the females who tend to be more drab. Individuals of both sexes want to avoid being eaten by predators, and there will be some evolutionary pressure on both sexes to be drably coloured. Bright colours attract predators no less than they attract sexual partners. In gene terms, this means that genes for bright colours are more likely to meet their end in the stomachs of predators than are genes for drab colours. On the other hand, genes for drab colours may be less likely than genes for bright colours to find themselves in the next generation, because drab individuals have difficulty in attracting a mate. There are, therefore, two conflicting selection pressures, predators tending to remove bright colour genes from the gene pool, and sexual partners tending to remove genes for drabness. As in so many other cases, efficient survival machines can be regarded as a compromise between conflicting selection pressures. What interests us at the moment is that the optimal compromise for a male seems to be different from the optimal compromise for a female. This is, of course, fully compatible with our view of males as high-risk, high-reward gamblers. Because a male produces many millions of sperms to every egg produced by a female, sperms heavily outnumber eggs in the population. Any given egg is therefore much more likely to enter into sexual fusion than any given sperm is. Eggs are a relatively valuable resource, and therefore a female does not need to be so sexually attractive as a male does in order to ensure that her eggs are fertilized. A male is perfectly capable of siring all the children born to a large population of females. Even if a male has a short life because his gaudy tail attracts predators or gets tangled in the bushes, he may have fathered a very large number of children before he dies. An unattractive or drab male may live even as long as a female, but he has few children, and his genes are not passed on. What shall it profit a male if he shall gain the whole world and lose his immortal genes? Another common sexual difference is that females are more fussy than males about whom they mate with. One of the reasons for fussiness by an individual of either sex is the need to avoid mating with a member of another species. Such hybridizations are a bad thing for a variety of reasons. Sometimes, as in the case of a man copulating with a sheep, the copulation does not lead to an embryo being formed, so not much is lost. When more closely related species like horses and donkeys crossbreed, however, the cost, at least to the female partner, can be considerable. An embryo mule is likely to be formed, and it then clutters up her womb for 11 months. It takes a large quantity of her total parental investment, not only in the form of food absorbed through the placenta and then later in the form of milk, but above all in time, which could have been spent in rearing other children. Then, when the mule reaches adulthood, it turns out to be sterile. This is presumably because, although horse chromosomes and donkey chromosomes are sufficiently similar to cooperate in the building of a good, strong mule body, they are not similar enough to work together properly in meiosis. Whatever the exact reason, the very considerable investment by the mother in the rearing of a mule is totally wasted from the point of view of her genes. Female horses should be very, very careful that the individual they copulate with is another horse and not a donkey. In gene terms, any horse gene that says, "Body, if you are female, copulate with any old male, whether he is a donkey or a horse," is a gene which may next find itself in the dead-end body of a mule, and the mother's parental investment in that baby mule detracts heavily from her capacity to rear fertile horses. A male, on the other hand, has less to lose if he mates with a member of the wrong species, and although he may have nothing to gain either, we should expect males to be less fussy in their choice of sexual partners. Where this has been looked at, it has been found to be true.
Even within a species, there may be reasons for fussiness. Incestuous mating, like hybridization, is likely to have damaging genetic consequences, in this case because lethal and semi-lethal recessive genes are brought out into the open. Once again, females have more to lose than males, since their investment in any particular child tends to be greater. Where incest taboos exist, we should expect females to be more rigid in their adherence to the taboos than males. If we assume that the older partner in an incestuous relationship is relatively likely to be the active initiator, we should expect that incestuous unions in which the male is older than the female should be more common than unions in which the female is older. For instance, father-daughter incest should be commoner than mother-son. Brother-sister incest should be intermediate in commonness. In general, males should tend to be more promiscuous than females. Since a female produces a limited number of eggs at a relatively slow rate, she has little to gain from having a large number of copulations with different males. A male, on the other hand, who can produce millions of sperms every day, has everything to gain from as many promiscuous matings as he can snatch. Excess copulations may not actually cost a female much other than a little lost time and energy, but they do not do her positive good. A male, on the other hand, can never get enough copulations with as many different females as possible. The word excess has no meaning for a male. We have not explicitly discussed man, but inevitably when we think about evolutionary arguments such as those in this chapter, we cannot help reflecting about our own species and our own experience. Notions of females withholding copulation until a male shows some evidence of long-term fidelity may strike a familiar chord. This might suggest that human females play the domestic bliss rather than the he-man strategy. Many human societies are indeed monogamous. In our own society, parental investment by both parents is large and not obviously unbalanced. Mothers certainly do more direct work for children than fathers do, but fathers often work hard in a more indirect sense to provide the material resources that are poured into the children. On the other hand, some human societies are promiscuous, and many are harem-based. What this astonishing variety suggests is that man's way of life is largely determined by culture rather than by genes. However, it is still possible that human males in general have a tendency towards promiscuity and females a tendency towards monogamy, as we would predict on evolutionary grounds. Which of these two tendencies wins in particular societies depends on details of cultural circumstance, just as in different animal species, it depends on ecological details. One feature of our own society that seems decidedly anomalous is the matter of sexual advertisement. As we have seen, it is strongly to be expected on evolutionary grounds that where the sexes differ, it should be the males that advertise and the females that are drab. Modern Western man is undoubtedly exceptional in this respect. It is, of course, true that some men dress flamboyantly and some women dress drably, but on average there can be no doubt that in our society the equivalent of the peacock's tail is exhibited by the female, not by the male. Women paint their faces and glue on false eyelashes. Apart from special cases like actors, men do not. Women seem to be interested in their own personal appearance, and they are encouraged in this by their magazines and journals. Men's magazines are less preoccupied with male sexual attractiveness, and a man who is unusually interested in his own dress and appearance is apt to arouse suspicion, both among men and among women. When a woman is described in conversation, it's quite likely that her sexual attractiveness, or lack of it, will be prominently mentioned. This is true whether the speaker is a man or a woman. When a man is described, the adjectives used are much more likely to have nothing to do with sex. Faced with these facts, a biologist would be forced to suspect that he was looking at a society in which females compete for males rather than vice versa. In the case of birds of paradise, we decided that females are drab because they do not need to compete for males. Males are bright and ostentatious because females are in demand and can afford to be choosy. The reason female birds of paradise are in demand is that eggs are a more scarce resource than sperms. What has happened in modern Western man? Has the male really become the sought-after sex, the one that is in demand, the sex that can afford to be choosy? If so, why?
Chapter 10. You scratch my back, I'll ride on yours. We have considered parental, sexual, and aggressive interactions between survival machines belonging to the same species. There are striking aspects of animal interactions which do not seem to be obviously covered by any of these headings. One of these is the propensity that so many animals have for living in groups. Birds flock, insects swarm, fish and whales school, plains-dwelling mammals herd together or hunt in packs. These aggregations usually consist of members of a single species only, but there are exceptions. Zebras often herd together with gnus, and mixed species flocks of birds are sometimes seen. The suggested benefits that a selfish individual can wrest from living in a group constitute rather a miscellaneous list. I'm not going to trot out the catalogue, but will mention just a few suggestions. In the course of this, I shall return to the remaining examples of apparently altruistic behaviour that I gave in Chapter 1, and which I promised to explain. This will lead into a consideration of the social insects, without which no account of animal altruism would be complete. Finally, in this rather miscellaneous chapter, I shall mention the important idea of reciprocal altruism, the principle of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
If animals live together in groups, their genes must get more benefit out of the association than they put in. A pack of hyenas can catch prey so much larger than a lone hyena can bring down that it pays each selfish individual to hunt in a pack, even though this involves sharing food. It is probably for similar reasons that some spiders cooperate in building a huge communal web. Emperor penguins conserve heat by huddling together. Each one gains by presenting a smaller surface area to the elements than he would on his own. A fish who swims obliquely behind another fish may gain a hydrodynamic advantage from the turbulence produced by the fish in front. This could be partly why fish school. A related trick concerned with air turbulence is known to racing cyclists, and it may account for the V formation of flying birds. There is probably competition to avoid the disadvantageous position at the head of the flock. Possibly the birds take turns as unwilling leader, a form of the delayed reciprocal altruism to be discussed at the end of the chapter. Many of the suggested benefits of group living have been concerned with avoiding being eaten by predators. An elegant formulation of such a theory was given by W. D. Hamilton in a paper called Geometry for the Selfish Herd. Lest this lead to misunderstanding, it's important to stress that by selfish herd he meant herd of selfish individuals.
Once again, we start with a simple model which, though abstract, helps us to understand the real world. Suppose a species of animal is hunted by a predator that always tends to attack the nearest prey individual. From the predator's point of view, this is a reasonable strategy, since it tends to cut down energy expenditure. From the prey's point of view, it has an interesting consequence. It means that each prey individual will constantly try to avoid being the nearest to a predator. If the prey can detect the predator at a distance, it will simply run away. But if the predator is apt to turn up suddenly without warning, say it lurks concealed in long grass, then each prey individual can still take steps to minimize its chance of being the nearest to a predator. We can picture each prey individual as being surrounded by a domain of danger. This is defined as that area of ground in which any point is nearer to that individual than it is to any other individual. For instance, if the prey individuals march spaced out in a regular geometric formation, the domain of danger around each one, unless he's on the edge, might be roughly hexagonal in shape. If a predator happens to be lurking in the hexagonal domain of danger surrounding individual A, then individual A is likely to be eaten. Individuals on the edge of the herd are especially vulnerable, since their domain of danger is not a relatively small hexagon, but includes a wide area on the open side. Now, clearly a sensible individual will try to keep his domain of danger as small as possible. In particular, he will try to avoid being on the edge of the herd. If he finds himself on the edge, he will take immediate steps to move towards the center. Unfortunately, somebody has to be on the edge, but as far as each individual is concerned, it is not going to be him. There will be a ceaseless migration in from the edges of an aggregation towards the center. If the herd was previously loose and straggling, it will soon become tightly bunched as a result of the inward migration. Even if we start our model with no tendency towards aggregation at all, and the prey animals start by being randomly dispersed, the selfish urge of each individual will be to reduce his domain of danger by trying to position himself in a gap between other individuals. This will quickly lead to the formation of aggregations which will become ever more densely bunched. Obviously, in real life, the bunching tendency will be limited by opposing pressures. Otherwise, all individuals would collapse in a writhing heap. But still, the model is interesting, as it shows us that even very simple assumptions can predict aggregation. Other, more elaborate models have been proposed. The fact that they are more realistic does not detract from the value of the simpler Hamilton model in helping us to think about the problem of animal aggregation.
The selfish herd model in itself has no place for cooperative interactions. There is no altruism here. Only selfish exploitation by each individual of every other individual. But in real life, there are cases where individuals seem to take active steps to preserve fellow members of the group from predators. Bird alarm calls spring to mind. These certainly function as alarm signals in that they cause individuals who hear them to take immediate evasive action. There is no suggestion that the caller is trying to draw the predator's fire away from his colleagues. He is simply informing them of the predator's existence, warning them. Nevertheless, the act of calling seems, at least at first sight, to be altruistic because it has the effect of calling the predator's attention to the caller. We can infer this indirectly from a fact which was noticed by P. R. Mahler. The physical characteristics of the calls seem to be ideally shaped to be difficult to locate. If an acoustic engineer were asked to design a sound that a predator would find it hard to approach, he would produce something very like the real alarm calls of many small songbirds. Now, in nature, this shaping of the calls must have been produced by natural selection, and we know what that means. It means that large numbers of individuals have died because their alarm calls were not quite perfect. Therefore, there seems to be danger attached to giving alarm calls. The selfish gene theory has to come up with a convincing advantage of giving alarm calls which is big enough to counteract this danger. In fact, this is not very difficult. Bird alarm calls have been held up so many times as awkward for the Darwinian theory that it's become a kind of sport to dream up explanations for them. As a result, we now have so many good explanations that it's hard to remember what all the fuss was about. Obviously, if there is a chance that the flock contains some close relatives, a gene for giving an alarm call can prosper in the gene pool because it has a good chance of being in the bodies of some of the individuals saved. This is true even if the caller pays dearly for his altruism by attracting the predator's attention to himself.
If you are not satisfied with this kin selection idea, there are plenty of other theories to choose from. There are many ways in which the caller could gain selfish benefit from warning his fellows. Trivers reels off 5 good ideas, but I find the following 2 of my own rather more convincing. The first I call the KV theory, from the Latin for beware, still used by schoolboys to warn of approaching authority. This theory is suitable for camouflaged birds that crouch frozen in the undergrowth when danger threatens. Suppose a flock of such birds is feeding in a field. A hawk flies past in the distance. He has not yet seen the flock, and he is not flying directly towards them, but there is a danger that his keen eyes will spot them at any moment, and he will race into the attack. Suppose one member of the flock sees the hawk, but the rest have not yet done so. This one sharp-eyed individual could immediately freeze and crouch in the grass. But this would do him little good, because his companions are still walking around conspicuously and noisily. Any one of them could attract the hawk's attention, and then the whole flock is in peril. From a purely selfish point of view, the best policy for the individual who spots the hawk first is to hiss a quick warning to his companions, and so shut them up and reduce the chance that they will inadvertently summon the hawk into his own vicinity. The other theory I want to mention may be called the never break ranks theory. This one is suitable for species of birds that fly off when a predator approaches, perhaps up into a tree. Once again, imagine that one individual in a flock of feeding birds has spotted a predator. What is he to do? He could simply fly off himself without warning his colleagues. But now he would be a bird on his own, no longer part of a relatively anonymous flock, but an odd man out. Hawks are actually known to go for odd pigeons out, but even if this were not so, there are plenty of theoretical reasons for thinking that breaking ranks might be a suicidal policy. Even if his companions eventually follow him, the individual who first flies up off the ground temporarily increases his domain of danger. Whether Hamilton's particular theory is right or wrong, there must be some important advantage in living in flocks, otherwise the birds would not do it. Whatever that advantage may be, the individual who leaves the flock ahead of the others will, at least in part, forfeit that advantage. If he must not break ranks, then what is the observant bird to do? Perhaps he should just carry on as if nothing had happened and rely on the protection afforded by his membership of the flock. But this too carries grave risks. He's still out in the open, highly vulnerable. He would be much safer up in a tree. The best policy is indeed to fly up into a tree, but to make sure everybody else does too. That way he will not become an odd man out, and he will not forfeit the advantage of being part of a crowd, but he will gain the advantage of flying off into cover. Once again, uttering a warning call is seen to have a purely selfish advantage. E.L. Charnoff and J.R. Krebs have proposed a similar theory in which they go so far as to use the word manipulation to describe what the calling bird does to the rest of his flock. We have come a long way from pure disinterested altruism.
Superficially, these theories may seem incompatible with the statement that the individual who gives the alarm call endangers himself. Really, there is no incompatibility. He would endanger himself even more by not calling. Some individuals have died because they gave alarm calls, especially the ones whose calls were easy to locate. Other individuals have died because they did not give alarm calls. The KV theory and the never break ranks theory are just 2 out of many ways of explaining why. What of the Stotting Thompson's gazelle, which we mentioned in Chapter 1, and whose apparently suicidal altruism moved Audrey to state categorically that it could be explained only by group selection. Here, the selfish gene theory has a more exacting challenge. Alarm calls in birds do work, but they are clearly designed to be as inconspicuous and discreet as possible. Not so the stotting high jumps. They are ostentatious to the point of downright provocation. The gazelles look as if they are deliberately inviting the predator's attention, almost as if they are teasing the predator. This observation has led to a delightfully daring theory. The theory was originally foreshadowed by N. Smythe, but pushed to its logical conclusion, it bears the unmistakable signature of A. Zahavi. Zahavi's theory can be put like this. The crucial bit of lateral thinking is the idea that stotting, far from being a signal to the other gazelles, is really aimed at the predators. It is noticed by the other gazelles, and it affects their behaviour, but this is incidental, for it is primarily selected as a signal to the predator. Translated roughly into English, it means, "Look how high I can jump. I am obviously such a fit and healthy gazelle. You can't catch me. You would be much wiser to try and catch my neighbour who's not jumping so high." In less anthropomorphic terms, genes for jumping high and ostentatiously are unlikely to be eaten by predators because predators tend to choose prey who look easy to catch. In particular, many mammal predators are known to go for the old and the unhealthy. An individual who jumps high is advertising, in an exaggerated way, the fact that he is neither old nor unhealthy. According to this theory, the display is far from altruistic. If anything, it is selfish, since its object is to persuade the predator to chase somebody else. In a way, there is a competition to see who can jump the highest, the loser being the one chosen by the predator.
The other example that I said I would return to is the case of the kamikaze bees who sting honey raiders but commit almost certain suicide in the process. The honeybee is just one example of a highly social insect. Others are wasps, ants, and termites, or white ants. I want to discuss social insects generally, not just suicidal bees. The exploits of the social insects are legendary. In particular, their astonishing feats of cooperation and apparent altruism. Suicidal stinging missions typify their prodigies of self-abnegation. In the honeypot ants, there is a caste of workers with grotesquely swollen, food-packed abdomens whose sole function in life is to hang motionless from the ceiling like bloated light bulbs being used as food stores by the other workers. In the human sense, they do not live as individuals at all. Their individuality is subjugated, apparently to the welfare of the community. A society of ants, bees, or termites achieves a kind of individuality at a higher level. Food is shared to such an extent that one may speak of a communal stomach. Information is shared so efficiently by chemical signals and by the famous dance of the bees that the community behaves almost as if it were a unit with a nervous system and sense organs of its own. Foreign intruders are recognized and repelled with something of the selectivity of a body's immune reaction system. The rather high temperature inside a beehive is regulated nearly as precisely as that of the human body, even though an individual bee is not a warm-blooded animal. Finally, and most importantly, the analogy extends to reproduction. The majority of individuals in a social insect colony are sterile workers. The germ line, the line of immortal gene continuity, flows through the bodies of a minority of individuals, the reproductives. These are the analogues of our own reproductive cells in our testes and ovaries. The sterile workers are the analogy of our liver, muscle, and nerve cells.
Kamikaze behavior and other forms of altruism and cooperation by workers are not astonishing once we accept the fact that they are sterile. The body of a normal animal is manipulated to ensure the survival of its genes, both through bearing offspring and through caring for other individuals containing the same genes. Suicide in the interests of caring for other individuals is incompatible with future bearing of one's own offspring. Suicidal self-sacrifice therefore seldom evolves. But a worker bee never bears offspring of its own. All its efforts are directed to preserving its genes by caring for relatives other than its own offspring. The death of a single sterile worker bee is no more serious to its genes than is the shedding of a leaf in autumn to the genes of a tree. There is a temptation to wax mystical about the social insects, but there's really no need for this. It's worth looking in some detail at how the selfish gene theory deals with them, and in particular, at how it explains the evolutionary origin of that extraordinary phenomenon of worker sterility from which so much seems to follow. A social insect colony is a huge family, usually all descended from the same mother. The workers, who seldom or never reproduce themselves, are often divided into a number of distinct castes, including small workers, large workers, soldiers, and highly specialized castes, like the honeypots. Reproductive females are called queens. Reproductive males are sometimes called drones or kings. In the more advanced societies, the reproductives never work at anything except procreation, but at this one task they are extremely good. They rely on the workers for their food and protection, and the workers are also responsible for looking after the brood. In some ant and termite species, the queen has swollen into a gigantic egg factory, scarcely recognizable as an insect at all, hundreds of times the size of a worker and quite incapable of moving. She is constantly tended by workers who groom her, feed her, and transport her ceaseless flow of eggs to the communal nurseries. If such a monstrous queen ever has to move from the royal cell, she rides in state on the backs of squadrons of toiling workers. In Chapter 7, we discussed the distinction between bearing and caring and concluded that mixed strategies, combining bearing and caring, would normally evolve. In Chapter 5, we saw that mixed evolutionarily stable strategies could be of two general types. Either each individual in the population could behave in a mixed way, thus individuals usually achieve a judicious mixture of bearing and caring, or the population may be divided into two different types of individual. This was how we first pictured the balance between hawks and doves. Now it is theoretically possible for an evolutionarily stable balance between bearing and caring to be achieved in the latter kind of way. The population could be divided into bearers and carers. But this can only be evolutionarily stable if the carers are close kin to the individuals for whom they care, at least as close as they would be to their own offspring if they had any. Although it is theoretically possible for evolution to proceed in this direction, it seems to be only in the social insects that it has actually happened.
Endnote. That is what we all thought when I wrote the original text. We had reckoned without naked mole rats. Naked mole rats are a species of hairless, nearly blind little rodents that live in large underground colonies in dry areas of Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. They appear to be truly social insects of the mammal world. Jennifer Jarvis's pioneering studies of captive colonies at the University of Cape Town have now been extended by the field observations of Robert Brett in Kenya. Further studies of captive colonies are being made in America by Richard Alexander and Paul Sherman. These four workers have promised a joint book, and I, for one, eagerly await it. Meanwhile, this account is based upon reading what few papers have been published and listening to research lectures by Paul Sherman and Robert Brett. I was also privileged to be shown the London Zoo's colony of naked mole rats by the then curator of mammals, Brian Bertram. Naked mole rats live in extensive networks of underground burrows. Colonies typically number 70 or 80 individuals, but they can increase into the hundreds. The network of burrows occupied by one colony can be 2 or 3 miles in total length, and one colony may excavate 3 or 4 tons of soil annually. Tunneling is a communal activity. A face worker digs at the front with its teeth, passing the soil back through a living conveyor belt, a seething, scuffling line of half a dozen little pink animals. From time to time, the face worker is relieved by one of the workers behind. Only one female in the colony breeds over a period of several years. Jarvis, in my opinion legitimately, adopts social insect terminology and calls her the queen. The queen is mated by two or three males only. All the other individuals of both sexes are non-breeding, like insect workers. And, as in many social insects,